Welcome to the C Word, the Conservatives podcast. Today we're talking about local little museums. I'm Jenny Mathiasen, an objects conservator based in Carmarthen in Wales. Hey guys, don't worry, it isn't literally just me. It's just I'm just doing the intro on my own. That's all it is. We're all in this episode, including the people on maternity leave. We've all made an effort for you this time. And yeah, it's really nice. What we're doing today is we're going around local little museums, as the title might suggest. You know, often we get caught up in the big museums, the nationals, the big boys. And, you know, there's a lot of love out there for little museums. Something that can be really local or can be just really, I don't know, like a little micro museum. Those things are wonderful. So this time we've all visited one. Have a listen.
For my little local museum visit, I took the opportunity of being on holiday in the Lake District to visit the Derwent Pencil Museum, which has been a long-standing ambition of mine ever since I heard about the Pencil Museum. I fell in love with pencils while training as a conservator because we write in pencil, and actually I've grown to just love writing with pencil. The way it resists the paper feels more satisfying to write with than a pen. I think there's something kind of beautiful about the fact that graphite pencil is light fast, so it could last indefinitely. However, you could simply rub it out in a matter of seconds. There's just something kind of poignant about that. You might think I'm being a bit ridiculous here, but I'm sure the people of the Pencil Museum would not disagree with me. So I whipped my children up into a fervour of enthusiasm for the prospect of seeing the world's biggest pencil. And I've made a recording of our trip to the museum, and I think it requires a bit of a preface because it's really quite immersive. So to explain the museum, it's in quite a new building. It's very cool, quite contemporary. So they give you your ticket, which is a pencil, and then you enter the museum through a replica graphite mine. And our kids were given a little trail to follow, you know, find these pictures, various things like that, which is nice. They get some bit more engaged and they've got something to do with their pencil that they've just been given. It all ties in very nicely. So you go in through this mine and then you come out into the museum, and the museum is laid out, I guess, in the structure of a pencil, because you've got displays that go round in a kind of big circle around the outside of the room. And then once you've gone all the way round, then there's an entrance, an opening to the middle, which is its own area. And that's where the world's biggest pencil is. I love that they chose to make it yellow. I don't know, it's just another touch that of its kind of silliness. And it's... I feel like that kind of the shape, the layout. I imagine maybe that's a deliberate echoing of the shape of the inside of a pencil. You know, if you think of the cross section, you've got the core and the outside and the wood around it. So that's a nice touch. Some highlights of the museum are the World War II secret pencil map, where they realized that pilots always have a pencil on them. That was part of their standard equipment. And if a pilot found themselves stranded in enemy territory, perhaps they'd had to parachute out, they needed a map. But they needed the map to be secret. So what they did is they found a way to insert a very, very thin paper, a map instead of a pencil core into these pencils. So that was very cool. There was a whole bit on that. So as I say, you start from this graphite mine, and then it takes you through the history of the local discovery of graphite, the mining, all the history. My favourite fact from that is that at some point graphite became very popular to deal with on the black market. So there was a lot of smuggling. And the reason the black market is called the black market is because if you were dealing with graphite, you ended up with black hands from it smudging onto your hands. So that's where the term black market comes from. So that was my top fact. And that's a really nice way, I think, that they've just really followed the kind of the journey of the material. And I guess that's the beauty of a whole museum just based on one object, one material object. And it kind of, you know, you've got the materials and then you've got the construction of an actual pencil. There was a display showing exactly how pencils are made with a kind of cross section so you can see. Yeah, I think for conservators, this is like the perfect museum because we love knowing how things are made and the relationship with their materials and the history. And, you know, this history is very much grounded in the local area. So let's get to the point, as it were. And here's the recording.
Is he on the list? No, he's not on the list.
Okay.
That those are examples of Oronale graphite, of the type which the early pencil makers sawed into flat sheets for insertion into the wooden cases of pencils.
I don't know why there are skulls though.
So these are all toys that are, or these are all rubbers. So I guess this shows all the different things that you can make erase, you know, because rubbers rub out pencil. And so you can make all sorts of fun things out of rubber.
What's he doing? What do you think he's doing?
Hiding.
What's he doing with the shovel?
I think digging.
Yeah, I think his job is to dig the material that they make the inside of pencils from. Underground. Yeah, he's a miner.
What would you like to show me next?
Nothing. Toys.
Yes.
Have you done a good job?
Do you know what these are?
What?
These are pencil sharpeners.
Did you know that this one looks a bit like me? This is a Lufalira.
Can you come with me to look at the world's biggest pencil?
Of course.
Would you like to tell me what you think of the world's biggest pencil?
I think... Well... I think it was really hard to make.
That's right.
And
how do you think they made it?
Maybe they found all the graphite and got the wood and painted it.
Yeah.
That's really complicated to make.
We can look at the pictures. So this is how they make pencils. So these are the raw materials that go into the coloured bit in the middle. So you've got gum, two different types of wax, graphite, which is the stuff that gets dug out of the ground in a mine, and clay. And then all different pigments, the colours, if you're making a coloured pencil. And that gets mixed together and turned into a core, which is like a long coloured rod, basically. And then they make the slats. So they get just a plain piece of wood and then they cut grooves into it, these lines, and then they lay the leads in those grooves. Do you see? And then they put another one on top that's also got grooves on. So then the leads are inside the wood. They kind of cut around the rods in a semicircle on each side and they come out as circles.
Yeah.
That's really clever, isn't it? And they've shown a cross section here so that we can see what it looks like on the inside. And then, what's the last step?
Pencil. Sharpen the pencil.
That's right.
And then you got pencil.
Exactly.
My name's Clive Farrer. I'm the production services manager with the Cumberland Pencil Company. And I'm here today to tell you a little bit about the special replica wartime pencil we made for the Borrowdale box.
Hello everyone. I have recently become a mother to a beautiful little girl.
and as a third-generation Pontic Greek refugee, I find myself thinking more and more about what it means to pass down history. Not just facts and names, but also memory, pain, resilience, and identity. It's been over 100 years since my great-grandparents were forced to flee their homes back in northern Turkey. And that century might feel distant to my daughter one day, perhaps a story in books rather than her actual reality. But the truth is, everything she has today and everything I've had the chance to become, it's because my great-grandparents survived and found their way to mainland Greece with almost nothing and somehow had to start their life again. So today, I decided to go visit the Museum of Greek Refugees in the city of Kavala. It's a place that recounts the history of the Asia Minor refugees, so not exactly the Pontic refugees, but it's a very similar story. It happened at the same time. So there's a lot of commonalities there. I am also bringing my mother, who is 100% Pontic and grew up in mainland Greece. It will be fun to share that with her and with her new granddaughter. So I don't know exactly what I'll be finding in this museum. It is two little rooms, apparently. But what I know is that it holds items that were brought by these Asia Minor refugees when they first moved to the Kavala area. And it will be interesting to see what felt important for them to carry with them, because of course they didn't have much luggage. These items were then donated to the museum about 90 years after the 1922 Asia Minor forceful displacement. Okay, so I've arrived in front of the museum. It is literally stuck onto the Ottoman aqueduct of Kavala, and it is in what used to be the Ottoman Madrasa of Kavala, so that would be the educational institution. Okay, guys. The entrance to this museum is quite magical. And it doesn't really have to do with the decor itself and the objects exhibited. It's more about the feeling. As soon as I stepped into the entrance, I was greeted by the two curators of the museum who were ready to give me a detailed tour. And the first thing they did was to ask me and my mother where we are from. This opened up the discussion of our family history and allowed them to connect and talk about their own family history, but also to mention some previous visitors who have a similar story or who have come from the same region as our ancestors. What's really wonderful about that is the fact that no tour is the same, and that the curators probably decide to focus on certain objects within the exhibit that would speak more to the current visitors. That way they can adapt to the visitors and their stories and highlight pieces of history that would be more relatable to them. What I really loved is that the first thing that our tour guide showed us was pictures of his grandmother who arrived in the Kavala area in 1924, and his parents as well, their wedding picture, taken in 1938. So apparently today, the museum hosts about 1,300 objects, 700 of which are visible within the exhibits. You have to think that 700 objects for such a small surface area is actually quite substantial. But I, of course, had to ask where the rest of the objects are. Apparently, most of those are documents, and they are stored within the wooden chests that I see laying around the rooms. Right, so the first thing one can see is embroidery. There's embroidery absolutely everywhere. On every table, on every window, you have curtains, you have bed linens, you have mannequins wearing embroidered gowns, You have embroidered napkins under every silverware. There's just white lace absolutely everywhere. It really feels like you're transported to a different century. Upon entering the museum, my mom said that she recognizes a lot of the objects and heirlooms, that she herself had many of those objects in her own home, and that it reminded her of her childhood. I can talk about a lot of things that are in here, but something that struck my eye is a little baby doll that apparently a 9-year-old brought to Kavala in 1924 from Zmirni, which is modern-day Izmir. And next to this doll are pictures of her two daughters holding this doll. And apparently her granddaughter then gifted this doll to the museum, and it's here with the pictures of her mother and her aunt holding that doll. Another really beautiful thing that I have never seen before is embroidered icons. Another thing that I see all around the rooms is keys. So a lot of these people brought their keys with them, thinking that eventually they will be going back, alongside some little charms in the shape of anchors, which symbolized the hope of eventually taking a boat and going back to their homeland. There are also some dowry contracts, some birth certificates, some marriage certificates hanging all around the walls, and also life insurance policies. In fact, one of the two rooms consists of the dowry of a young woman whose father had a life insurance policy back in Constantinople and who used that money to buy furniture and clothing for his daughter's dowry. And now the dowry contract listing those objects, as well as the objects themselves, a picture of the father and a picture of the daughter and her husband, make up most of this first room's content. Other interesting heirlooms that were included in the exhibit were prayer books, which were written in the Karamanlidiki language, which consists of the Turkish language, but written with the Greek alphabet. So the story behind this is, in Cappadocia, the Greeks of the region were given two choices: to either give up their religion or give up their language. Many of them decided to give up their language, and therefore they continued practicing Christian orthodoxy, but the prayer books were now written in the Karamanlidiki language. In fact, one of the two curators made the visit extra special by grabbing four Cappadocian spoons and using them as percussion while singing a traditional Cappadocian song. It was quite an emotional moment for me because somehow my mom joined in the middle of the song. Perhaps one of the most interesting finds is a big braided lock of hair dating from 1924. It belonged to a woman who came to the Kavala region from Asia Minor, and who, during her quarantine, had her beautiful long hair cut off. However, she managed to keep it, and once the quarantine was over, in order not to suffer shame and not to differentiate from the local women, she added a ribbon to it and was able to attach it to her hair under her headscarf so that it would go unnoticed. One last story I would like to share with you guys is that of the sakura tree, which is found near the entrance of the museum. As soon as you enter the museum, one of the first pictures you see is that of George Horton, who was the American ambassador in Smyrna between 1911 and 1922. During the fires of Smyrna in September of 1922, he helped a lot of Asia Minor Greeks who were trying to escape through the coast by transporting them out of there by boat and bringing them to Mytilene, and also by issuing them fake US passports so that they wouldn't be refused entry due to their political views. So a few years ago, the Museum Association wanted to honored Horton's work by giving an award to his daughter, who was well into her 80s at the time. The daughter happily accepted the award. However, she said that they should invite the Japanese ambassador to Greece. Now, the members of the association didn't know this, but during the Smyrna fires, there was a Japanese pilot who saw all of these people running towards the sea and did more than 10 trips between Smyrna and the Greek islands, carrying hundreds of refugees. Now, the name of the pilot was unknown by the daughter. However, she thought it appropriate to also give an award to the Japanese ambassador in memory of the good action of this man. And so, alongside this award, a sakura tree was also planted in honor and memory of this anonymous pilot. My visit to the Museum of Greek Refugees reminded me why I love small local museums in Greek towns and villages so much. These spaces often focus more on the small local stories than the larger scale historical events, and they are filled with emotions that really stay with you for a long time after you leave. There's something deeply personal about them, from heartfelt narratives to the people who welcome you and are eager to share with you what they know. This visit wasn't just about the exhibited objects. It was about the conversations and the human connection that brought everything to life. As for the personal connection that I made with the staff, they were all so happy to see me come in with my newborn and mentioned that she was the youngest visitor they've ever had. To honor that, one of the tour guides wanted to demonstrate how babies were traditionally swaddled in the 1800s in Asia Minor and sang a traditional lullaby.
Ύπνε που παίρνει στα μωρά, έλα πάρε και τούτο. Μικρό μικρό σου το δώσα, μεγάλο φέρε μου το. Κοιμήσου και παρήγγυλα στην πόλη τα φρικιά σου, στη Βενετιά τα ρούχα σου και τα χρυσάφικα σου. Νάνι, 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 το μωράκι μου να κάνει. Νάνι, 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 κι όπου το πονεί να γιάνει. Νάνι και τον ανουρίζω, τρία κάστρα του χαρίζω. Το μισήρι και τη βόλη, τη μικρά Ασία όλη.
Hey everybody, this is Liz calling in from Amsterdam. I'm in the red light district right now looking for a small little house museum or something. There are actually a lot of museums in the area, so I'm a bit spoiled for choice, but I think I'm going to go into a really cool museum called Our Lord in the Attic. So this museum is a house museum, 17th century house museum, as well as a church. And the reason for that is that the Netherlands was owned by Spain for a while before the 17th century. And then in the late 1600s, they decided that they didn't want to be owned by Spain anymore, both for political reasons, but also religious, because Spain was Catholic and the Netherlands had become more Protestant during the Reformation, and they wanted their country to reflect their religious beliefs. So they did gain independence through the 80 Years' War and the Dutch Revolt. But after that, they were very religiously accepting. So the country did become Protestant, but they didn't mind if you were Catholic as long as you weren't very loud about it. So museums like this highlight some of the Catholic history in a Protestant country where they had to make their churches in secret. So this church is a full church. It's in the attic of this 17th century canal house, and people would have attended mass here. It wasn't super secret, like they weren't working illegally. It's not that kind of secret church, but it was very much more quiet and not as announced as the Protestant churches would have been. So let's go inside. Okay, so in the end, I decided not to record anything inside the museum because it was quite a quiet museum, which is really nice, especially since it's right in the middle of the red light district and that can be a bit of a rowdy area. But it felt very quiet and calm. It's technically two different buildings, so the museum has bought the house that's next to Our Lord in the attic, and that sort of functions as their exhibition space, office space as well, and the entryway. And they currently had a really cool exhibition going on that was all about the miracle of Amsterdam. So the miracle of Amsterdam happened in, I think, like the 13th century, so like the 1400s. And it was a miracle where a man was very deathly ill and he took his last rites. So the priest came, a Catholic priest, because they would have been Catholic at the time. The priest came and gave him the Eucharist, which is part of like the end of your life when a priest is helping you go into the afterlife. And unfortunately, he threw it up. And when you have the Eucharist, because it's the body of Christ, you have to dispose of it. You can't just let it sit there after it's been thrown up. So they put it into the fireplace and they left him in peace to die. But the next day, when the maid was tending to the fire, she saw that the Eucharist was still inside of it, even though it had burned all night long and it should have been, you know, ashes by now. And then it survived a few fires, I think, throughout its time. But this is the miracle of Amsterdam. And after this story was confirmed by the church, it made it a religious right to go to Amsterdam as a pilgrimage and go see the Eucharist and the place where this miracle happened. So that's a really cool exhibition that they have on right now. I think it's a really big part of the history of the city of Amsterdam. And the exhibition is in two parts. So they have all of the facts about the miracle of Amsterdam, as well as some paintings about it, some information about the priest that popularized this myth. And then on the other floor down below, they have an exhibition where local artists in Amsterdam have done artwork that is inspired by the miracle of Amsterdam, and that's all on display as part of the exhibit, which I think is really cool to incorporate something contemporary into this really, really old story that's part of Amsterdam. And I didn't see anything written about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if the reason that they're having this exhibition now is because this year is the 750-year anniversary of the city of Amsterdam. So that would have been around the same time that this miracle happened. As for the museum itself, you go in through like the basement and you work your way up from the bottom of the house to the top. So first you move through the living quarters. That's like the front entry room, some of the bedrooms, as well as the big receiving room at the back of the house. My favorite room that was part of this living space was actually the kitchen, which was down at the back of the house in the bottom floor. It has a really cool like skylight, basically. I'll put some photos of it up on Instagram and we'll link below. But the look of this room felt more like mid-20th century than it did 17th century. So I thought that was really interesting, you know, how style kind of repeats itself and we're always just working in a circle. And then going up to the top floor, so it's actually the church takes up like the top two or three floors of the building because they have balcony spaces so that they could fit everybody, because this would have been a lot of people going into the church on Sundays to worship and doing it very, very quietly, you know, not under cover of night or anything, but they are going to, they weren't allowed to make like a big deal of it. You couldn't have religious processions for many years in the Netherlands because they didn't want Catholics to be gathering together in that way. But the church is fully functioning. It has all the things that you would expect for a Catholic church to have. It even has, you know, the area where the priests get ready. Oh gosh, what's that called? Sacristy. That's what it is. So there's a tiny little sacristy, very modest, behind the altar, out of view of the congregation. And then on the floor below, they even have a treasury where they keep all of their religious items and, you know, anything that would be gold or anything worth money, perhaps some of the materials that they would have used to conduct Mass or any reliquaries that they would have had as well. It's a really nice space. I wonder if they actually ever do Mass, because I always think that it's interesting to see a church not only as, you know, from my perspective as an art historian from the art history side of things, but also it being used still today as a place of worship, I think is really interesting. But I don't know if they do services here anymore, because it is technically very much a museum. Like, the only entrance to it is through that other house that I mentioned before. They do have an organ, though. I'd be curious if that's restored. It's a tiny little organ, and it would have filled up this place very well. I'm sure that they couldn't have played it very loud, because, again, you don't really want to announce yourself. And Catholic music would have been different from Protestant music, just how Protestant art and Catholic art are stylistically very different from each other. And then in terms of it being a museum, I really liked how they had these like QR code sections where you could either tap your phone or you could get a little headphone piece that worked with Bluetooth down on the ground floor. And then you just tap it against these little markers in each room and it tells you all of the information about all of the rooms that you're going through, which was a really great way to learn because nobody is crowding up around one piece of text based information, but also because it is such a small museum and space, it is possible for you to walk through quietly instead of, you know, hearing a lot of people talking. So it did keep the volume of the museum down. Might also have been that I was there on a very quiet day. But it actually reminded me a lot of the Rembrandt Museum, which is just a few blocks away, also in the city center of Amsterdam, and also technically a house museum with an artist's studio on the top floor instead of a church. Although that does remind me, I've been reading a lot of the letters of Vincent van Gogh lately, and there seems to be a really big connection between someone who like religious pursuit and artistic pursuit in terms of sort of like the mentality that is required in order to dedicate yourself to something like that for your whole life. Just a little food for thought there. I really liked Our Lord in the Attic. I have been here before, to be completely honest, but it was a few years ago, and what really stood out for me on this trip was the Miracle of Amsterdam exhibit, which I think was really cool. And if anyone is in town this year, I'm sure that they'll have it up for another few months because the anniversary of the city isn't until October. So if you are in Amsterdam in the next few months, you should definitely check out Our Lord in the Attic.
I am in Shipton Hall, outside of Shipton Hall, which is owned by Calderdale Council, and it's part of Calderdale Museums. I'm here with my family and my tiny boy. So Emery is my visiting companion. He has the hiccups at the moment, so that's what that noise is. I've eaten my ice cream from the sort of park centre down the hill.
mint and chocolate chip, if you're interested. And I am standing in front of... my Aunt Frances is gesticulating towards Chipton Hall, open, last entry 4 p.m, adults £10, concessions £7.50, family members, or family £27.50. Am I at the front entrance? I don't know. This is the house made famous by Anne Lister, dramatised as Gentleman Jack, if you've seen it. I've only seen series one because the pig storyline stressed me out. And yeah, let's have a look. So we've come in through the extension to the original Tudor Hall. Very knowledgeable volunteers. And we're just walking through. We walked through the kitchen to begin with, my favourite bit. And it's proper, you know, historic house, room set up, gloriness. Lovely low ceilings, all original, I think. Amazing. I'm not sure about the internal furnishings, but it's really, really nice. It's really nice. Ooh, fire alarm. I'm going to see how many boring Dell Museum snaps things I can find. oh, there's front entrance. There's a barn. Apparently there's a folk museum. Barn and Folk Museum in the barn. So we'll go there later. We've just walked into the study. Remembering all of this from the TV show. Down the hall. Where are we now? Little cupboard. As soon as we went in, there was a really cool, like, original, you know, one of those glazed, blocked off areas of original wall and doorway. Really, really cool. Oh, we've got more volunteers. Hello. Oh, cool. Where are we now? There's an information sign about the paintings. The house body. The house body is the heart of the hall. In the 15th century, both cooking and eating would have taken place in this room. So this is a tall vaulted ceiling, that's probably the wrong word, with a gallery and wooden stairs, and rooms off it in all directions and a huge fireplace. Oh, it's so cool. It's really nicely kept. There's a couple of things, like there's in the study there were some leather covered bookshelves, and some of the leather could have done with some work, so Calderdale Council gets funding some conservation, please. Everything is so nicely kept. There are, because it's near Easter, little Easter bunny models dotted around. Oh, I'm in the Savile room now. I should read the thing, shouldn't I? Believe the hall's earliest period this room was used as a bedroom. Cool. We are now in the dining room. Hello, Mum. amazing wood carvings on the walls. Amazing. So there's oak on one side of a huge fireplace. So oak leaves. And ivy on the other side. It's really, really gorgeous. I'm really enjoying how you can see the way they've sensitively put in the more modern things. So, like, the private sign on one of the doors that go off the dining room. But you can see, like, the wear on the floor of where it was opened. So you can tell that it is used. And, you know, modern carpet to look in keeping. So it's really, it's all really subtle. It's really well done. Yeah, I'm really enjoying that. And there's information boards about the use of the rooms historically and in the TV show as well, because it's become a much more popular site since the TV show was released. Yeah, it's really cool. The carved stairs are incredible. Oh, what's this room? The buttery. What's the buttery? Derived from the French and Latin words. Modern word butler. I see. Built around 1590. Oh my god. So Anne Lister lived, or she lived, between 1791 and 1840. So there's a lot of different. I don't know what you're miming. You don't have to stop. Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I'm not good at charades. Right, let's go upstairs. Up the stairs. Good sound effect, isn't it? Really cool. Emery is now completely asleep, so turns out that the best way to get him to sleep is to visit a heritage property. I think I can manage that. Maybe not all the time. So in the first corridor, past Annister's funeral hatchment, they've used the different rooms and like wall cupboards, so wall panelled cupboards as display cases, which is really cool. It's really well done. So letter to Aunt Anne at Shibden Hall, and at the end of the corridor there's a glass door so you can see through it, like a display case basically, of her office. What is that? There's no sign on this one, but Mum just told me that this is where her letters were discovered, Annister's letters were discovered. It's so cool. It's all set out really nicely. Lights are quite bright, but I think most of the bits in the, on the table are facsimile. But there's a door open in the corner, and up the stairs, our bedroom. So outside the hall, the Folk Museum and barn is actually a huge area, like the rest of the outside of the site. Hello, Em. The rest of the outside of the site. So the barn is full of old carriages, seven massive carriages of different functions and different ages. And then past that, there's a sort of courtyarded, massive courtyarded area surrounded by buildings with different trades in them and stuff. So there's like apothecary and blacksmith and cooper's, whatever that is, basketry. It's really, really cool. Yeah, really enjoyed that, seeing all the tools set out and stuff. And presumably this is where they would have been, like a sort of trades village to support a large house. So, yeah, really, really cool. So around the site of the different trades, there's more cart storage and stuff in the cart sheds. In the cart sheds. Okay, yeah, obviously. Depressingly open to the elements, to be honest, but I'm guessing they don't have massive amounts of storage. But the paintings are still, the painted carts are still fairly good condition. Like, you can still see the red and stuff. But it does get weathered a lot up here. Oh, there's another room. I'm sort of chasing around after my family members. Coopers, by the way, cask makers. Who knew? I didn't even know a lot of these things were a thing. Really cool. Oh, hi, Emery. Hi. So we're on our way to the loos now, past the gorgeous grassed garden area on the front of the site. Really lovely. I'm a huge fan of that. My phone is about to die, and Emery is waking up and in need of a feed. But yeah, really nice site. I'm really impressed for a local authority heritage site. Really lovely. I imagine they've had funding, which helps, obviously. But yeah, lovely. Particularly liked the sort of trades section in the barn, which is a surprise because I love a historic house and room setups are so cool. Yeah, top marks. Calderdale Council, love it. Thanks very much.
Alrighty, I am in Larne in Carmarthenshire, and I'm about to go visit Dylan Thomas Boathouse, which is one of my local little museums that I haven't been to. It is a beautiful summer day. Not a cloud in the sky. I can see the sea. I'm on a path down towards it. This is about 250 metres from where I was dropped. Yeah, I reckon this is going to be nice.
Okay.
Oh, it really is a beautiful day. It's like a very nice little path that you walk down with like nice stone walls That fantastic view of the sea. The beach is looking lovely. The tide is really low today, so I can almost not see the water. That's not entirely true, but like, I can see more sludgy bits of the beach than I otherwise would. I'm loving this big sign I'm next to. It said, go back, no turning point ahead, no parking, stop, sat nav is wrong. And then someone's written on it in marker, I hold a beast, an angel, and a madman in me, Dylan Thomas. Love it. I'm definitely on the right path here. Fabulous. It's just such a gorgeous day. It's really nice and quiet. Right, if you don't know who Dylan Thomas is, he was a writer. Sort of considered one of the bards of Wales, really. He lived in quite recent memory. I can't remember his exact date, but I'm sure I will be informed as I get to the boathouse. Yes. Yeah, let's see how it is. I don't know if this place is going to be big or small. I mean, I'm assuming small. But I don't know. Boathouse can mean a lot of things, can't it? Let's see what it is. So it turns out the first thing you actually meet on the path isn't the boathouse. It's Dylan's writing shed. And I met a lovely staff member there. It was open today. Apparently that's really rare. It only happens once or twice a year. So that's incredible. Got really lucky with that. And apparently the shed, and it really is like a little shed, apparently built to house the first motor car in the whole area. Apparently that shed... it's where Dylan did all of his writing. So he didn't write in the boathouse, but he did write in the shed. So all of his famous stuff was really made there. It's a really lovely little shed. It is quite, like, sort of not open to the elements, but, you know, it's a shed. But it's really nice. And it's got his, like, yeah, bits of writing, and it's very much sort of left as is, like, as if he was just there. It's really nice and really inspiring. I think, oh god, the views alone out of the windows. I'd want to write in there. It's amazing. Oh, it was so nice. And the staff member was really like amped up about it as well. I loved it. It's great. It's really beautiful. What a fantastic place. Right, now we're going to try to get down some steps and visit the actual boathouse. Just gone down some steps and I'm approaching the boathouse, which is like not like a small building. It's not huge either, but like, yeah, bigger than I imagined it. There's some like beautiful summery laundry hanging out, which I'm guessing is very much a set piece. Pieces are waving in the wind. It's beautiful, and there are like big trees. I think there's a fig tree I'm under as I'm approaching. Very scenic.
Wide, wide and near, for who unmenningly haunts the mountain ravened eaves, or skulks in the dell moon, but moonshine echoing clear from the starred well. A hymn touches an angel out of a saint cell. The night bird lords through nunneries and domes of leaves.
Right now I'm in the boathouse. It's got two floors and somewhere down the steps and out back. There is also a tea room with a lovely view on the patio that I look forward to visiting in a little bit. Looks really nice. Good view. I can see the patio from up this window, actually. So downstairs, when you get in, you sort of turn immediately, and that's where you pay. You go through a little shop. And downstairs, there's the parlour that's set up to be as close to the bohemian 1950s home as possible. A lot of the things that Dylan Thomas and his family owned were sold off after his death. Pay bills and debts, as with most great artists, I suppose. Lived a life of poverty, so not that surprising. Mood. But they've tried to keep it as authentic as they can, with furniture from his parents' house, or things they know he owned, or things of a very similar style. And it's really cozy. It's they've got a recording downstairs of him talking on the radio, because he did a lot of radio. Yeah, it's very comfy. Upstairs is quite hot. The top floor is more of an exhibition space. So in one room, you can overhear it in the background. There's a video going, talking about his life. And some seats you can sit and take it all in. And the rest of the upper floor is very sort of paintings and prints, drawings, bits of Kamarzan journal, and signs explaining his life and his work. A bit about his home life and the time when the family lived in the boathouse, and his career as a writer and a poet, and all the letters he wrote, as well as the books. And yeah, it's just giving a bit of context to his life, really. And I was right, he did live much more recently than I think, because I always think of him as quite far removed in the past, and it's not true at all. He was born in 1914 and died in 1953. So it's quite a recent piece of history, relatively speaking. You know, this is 100 years ago, kind of thing. But yeah. Oh, this is a really lovely space. It's very chill. I think it caught it at just the right time. There's not many people about right now. There are loads of people milling about outside, so I think it's well visited, which is really nice to see. Yeah, it's really nice. I'm boiling hot now, so I think I'm going to go and make my way up the hill again, which might be a bit more of a struggle. But this has been really lovely. This is a good bite-sized place to visit. It's really nice. Yeah, recommended. That's a really nice little place to visit. It really is a local little museum. I loved it. It's local authority run, if you didn't say that. It's £6 for an adult to get in. But yeah, I think it is worth £6. I learned a lot in there. I learned an awful lot about his life and his work. And his family as well. So I thought it was really nice. So it's definitely somewhere you can visit even if you don't know anything about Dylan's work. And that's good, because I was a bit fearful that my ignorance would make me feel like, oh, this isn't for me. But I didn't feel like that at all. I did probably think that the writing shed was marginally more interesting than the boathouse in some ways, because it's just more retained and a better sense of, like, this is where the work happened. But I'm not sure if that's just me. Sometimes I just really appreciate seeing where someone did paint or did write or thought of discoveries, as opposed to this is where they had dinner with their family. But I don't know if that's just me. There are bits of the boathouse that you can't see because it's, you know, staff-only areas. So there is more to the house that you can't see, but the bits you can see are nice. Yeah, definitely worth a go.
Thanks for listening. We're the C Word, and today you've listened to Liz, Solange, Fedra, Chloe, and me, Jenny. Join us next time for an episode about early career freelancers. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show, email us on thecwordpodcast@gmail.com, or go find us on social media. We're on almost everything. The intro and outro music is Spring by Didi Music, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. As always, this has been a Wooden Dice production.